This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to Lifetime Income. Well, I'm enjoying my last day of my sabbatical, and I hope you're enjoying your Labor Day. This week on Lifetime Income, we'll be replaying Brainless is Painless, about smart ways to approach your retirement savings. But coming up first, one of our toughest discussions about portfolio diversification, debunking the doomsday prepper portfolios from our March 25th program. We know this is a sensitive topic right now for investors, especially with so many people predicting an imminent crash of the market or the dollar crash. Just got an imminent market crash prediction here in the last couple of weeks. But it's important to keep revisiting your investment philosophy to see if there's any new information that could change your thinking. So we hope you don't mind if we touch on this subject again.
And I'm Kathleen Harris. We want to repeat that we understand the motivations for having an eggs-in-one basket or an eggs-in-two baskets investment strategy. We're just really humbly asking you to consider the idea of, what if I'm wrong? Which, frankly, we do here at our firm all the time, just to make sure our thinking is still straight. This week, we'll be talking about a group we lovingly call here in the office, the Doomsday Preppers. We've heard a lot on cable channels about people who are prepping for doomsday by saving food, saving money, gathering firearms. Well, we've got investors who do essentially the same thing with their portfolios. So today, we'll be talking to people who are preparing their portfolios for either a dollar crash or a market crash or both, and talk about how the situation in Cyprus is giving us some lessons we need these people to pay attention to when they think about whether or not their portfolio truly is prepped for what they think might be coming.
Well, I would say, Kathleen, one of the common portfolio strategies that we see across the board are probably two and maybe three asset categories. You have larger concentrations of cash because you're worried about a stock market crash or a dollar crash. And the other asset is you might have a large concentration of gold. So I think the worst is going to come. One of the common questions we get here on the program on the weekend is a dollar crash, a stock market crash. So people are all in gold in cash, or even worse, they may be all in bonds. But typically, those are the three assets that we see in these what I call doomsday or crash portfolios. High concentrations of cash, high concentrations of gold, or all in bonds.
And Jim, we have to say we completely understand what's driving this desire to structure your portfolio this way. We know that people have been hit hard by the crash that happened in 2000, 2001. They got hit hard again in 2008. There's a lot of craziness going on with money printing. We understand the impulse to make a portfolio that's heavy in cash and heavy in gold. But there are some pros and cons of doing so, which we're going to cover in a little bit in the program. Jim, you mentioned one of the things that's common in these portfolios is a high concentration in cash. What does the situation in Cyprus tell us or teach us about having a high concentration of cash in your portfolio?
Well, there's two things. I'm not doing the weekend program, but one of the things that struck me, Kathleen, about Cyprus is there's two outcomes from Cyprus. Number one is the rule of contract law. So, for example, if I put money in a bank and I have deposit insurance of $100,000, I am basing that trust of putting that money in that financial institution on contract law, that the government in the financial institution is going to honor my $100,000 deposit or up to $100,000 deposit. Now, if the government can come in and say, well, we're really not honoring deposit insurance, we're going to call it a tax, whatever you're calling it, you are breaking contract law. And you tend to find this in a lot of what I call third world countries. This is something that Argentina did back at the beginning of the last decade when they confiscated bank accounts and went after pensions. And so that's one thing that should really stand out and give a moment of pause to people that have large amounts of concentration in cash, because when governments get desperate, in this case, whether it's Argentina in 2001 or it's Cyprus in 2013, they look for ways to get at assets that they're not getting in tax revenues. So that is one lesson. And you've seen it in numerous countries, Argentina, as I mentioned, Cyprus, North Korea. The worst asset to be in during times of extreme financial crisis could be bonds, because what happened in Argentina, what happened in Europe during the Greek crisis, you had Greek bond yields go from 6 and 7%, Kathleen, all the way down, all the way up to 30%. They're still at 10% today. So when a country gets into a financial crisis, there's two things you usually see. Number one, interest rates skyrocket, the currency collapses, and as the currency collapses, interest rates skyrocket. So if you're in bonds in that country in a crisis, what's going to happen is you're going to lose a lot of money in the bond market, and that's exactly what's happened. We've seen it happen in the last couple of years in Europe with the pig countries. I don't care if you're looking at Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, all of those countries, and now we're seeing it in Cyprus. And we've seen it in Argentina. So the worst area that you want to have your money in is the area that people are putting their money in now, expecting this doomsday scenario.
And Jim, like we mentioned, we completely understand this impulse. But again, you take the risk of confiscation if your money is in bank accounts. It's happened several times throughout world history. It's a bad place to be in case something happens. Let's talk a little bit toward the person that's really heavily invested in gold or silver, really exposed to precious metals. Let's just take a scenario, Jim, walk our listeners through. What would happen if the worst came to pass and the dollar collapsed? What would happen to the investment markets after that happened, Jim? What would the investment world look like if the dollar truly were to collapse?
Well, there's two things. If the dollar were to collapse, and if we take any of those currencies around the globe, whether it was the Argentine peso or Zimbabwe, the first thing that happens is assets that have a tangible value. That's farm, that's commodities, and it's stocks. Because if you own a stock, you own a percentage ownership in a business. Every single one of those scenarios throughout history, we've seen an increase in the nominal value of stocks. And probably at the extreme, Kathleen, is we can take Germany during the 1920s when they experienced hyperinflation. Their stock market went up by millions, and I'm saying millions percent. If we fast forward here into this decade of Zimbabwe, one way you maintain purchasing power was in the stock market. So if the dollar was to crash, you would see stock prices go up, as we did in Argentina, as we did in Russia, as we did in Turkey, as we did in Zimbabwe. All of these countries that have experienced a currency collapse or a severe decline in the value of their currency. In gold terms, gold prices would also go up. But here's a big difference. Governments look differently at gold than they do stocks. And if you take a look at the capital gains rate, the capital gains rate is much higher on gold than it is stocks, depending on where you are. Let's say, for example, you have income underneath $450,000 or $400,000 as a single individual. You're still under the old Bush capital gains tax rates, which can be as low as 10%. That is not the case with bullion. And what we've seen with a valuable asset, with gold, in the case of our own government, we've actually confiscated it. Now, I'm not saying that the U.S. government would confiscate it in the future, but they could do it indirectly through taxation. We already have a 28% tax rate on gold. Add to that, if you're in the state of California, you could pay up to 13.3. So you're already talking over 40% as it stands right now. But what if they add a windfall profits tax, as they did to the oil companies in the 70s, and those windfall profits tax remained in place well into the 80s, and I think it was Ronald Reagan that got rid of the windfall profits tax in his second term of office. So the government would look unfavorably towards gold. They're not going to say to gold investors, gee, you guys were pretty smart while we were printing money and debasing the currency, and you've gotten rich through your gold investment, we're going to lower capital gains rate and make it very favorable. Governments are always predisposed towards financial assets, either stocks or bonds. So in a dollar crisis, Kathleen, what would happen is tangible type assets, real estate, stocks, gold. There is this misperception. If a currency collapses, the only asset going up is gold. And an example I can give you right now is if we go back to September of last year, when the Fed announced QE3 or QE Infinity, as it's now known, or in the case of December, when they announced QE4, what has done best since QE? It's been the stock market, not the gold market.
Jim, I think this is a really important point to make because, again, we sort of have these doomsday or crash portfolios that are assuming when the dollar collapses that you won't want to be in stocks. And I think this goes back to how there's a misunderstanding of what a paper asset really is. I keep hearing investors call me and say, if the dollar collapses, I don't want to be in any paper assets, so sell my stock. And I think, Jim, that's part of the problem is that people don't really understand that a stock is not really a paper asset. Like you were mentioning, it's actually a tangible asset. True paper assets are cash and bonds. So again, if you're thinking about prepping for the dollar crash, one of the worst places to put your money is in cash or in those bonds. But stocks are not the worst place to put your money. In fact, they're a good place to put your money in case of a crash.
Well, a good example is if we go back to 2008, Kathleen, the CPI is up 15%. And let's just take the government's CPI numbers at face value. I know others think that the inflation rate is much higher, but CPI has gone up 15%. The dollar has lost 10% of its value. So if you've been in cash, your cash today has 25% less purchasing power than it did back in 2008. Now, if we look at asset classes, if you were in bonds, you did okay. You didn't lose money. You know, the income on your bonds have gone down since, and I'm referring to bond funds here because that's where most people are putting their money. But Kathleen, the stock market is up close to 140%. So here we have an asset that is responding to inflationary pressures and to a devaluation of the dollar. The problem today, it's not just the dollar that's being devalued. All currencies are being devalued. So that's why we're seeing, in nominal terms, we've seen the stock market go up. And my argument would be that a 130% increase in the value of stocks is far above the depreciation of the dollar or depreciation as a result of inflation. So if you've been in stocks and you're up 130%, you've more than maintained your purchasing power. That is not the case if you've been in bonds or, in this case, cash.
And Jim, I think this is sort of why I get a lot of calls right now from people who are doing what I'm calling coming out of the bunker. They've been in the bunker for a long time. They've been holding their cash, holding their gold, waiting for the end of the financial world to happen. And time keeps passing, and the financial world hasn't ended. But they've been sitting on cash for this whole time. They've missed out on all the up movement in the stock market. So now they're out there, they've got all this cash, they want to do something with it, but they're not really sure what to do.
Well, you know, it's one of the problems that I see here, and you know more about this because you take a lot of these calls, and you see three types of investors that are coming out of cash now. The first kind is the investor that has unrealistic expectations. They want to go back to an investment world that existed at the time they went into cash 5 and 6 years ago. So it's almost like there's this time warp. And you get this, and you tell this to me all the time. You get calls and you go, you know what? I'm tired of being in cash for 5 or 6 years. I need to get a 6 and 7% rate of return. Well, if we go back to 2006 and 2007, when the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates, in 2007, I could have put somebody in a 2-year treasury note and they would have got a 5% return. I take that same 2-year treasury note, I can't even get them 0.25%. So the yield on a 2-year treasury note has dropped by over 95%. Since 2007. So the world, number one, we're dealing in a different world today. And more importantly, Kathleen, this is a global world. In 2000, in the bear market, we were able to move our clients into foreign bonds when the Fed was lowering interest rates, because the bond yields in Europe, in Canada, in Australia, Switzerland, France, Germany were much, much higher than the bond yields here in the U.S., and it was the Fed that was printing money while other central banks were keeping tight money. So the dollar was going down in value along with interest rates, while foreign currencies were maintaining their purchasing power against the dollar, and the interest rates were much higher. That is not the world we live in today. I can look at a bond screen, and it doesn't matter. Wherever I look around the globe, and Rob and I often talk about this on the program, bond yields are low all over the place. You know, they're 1.9% here in the U.S. on a 10-year treasury. They're less than 1.9 in the U.K. France, they're less than 2%. In Switzerland, they're less than 0.75%. In Japan, they're barely above 0.5%. There's no place around the globe that I can go to get these 6% and 7% returns that you're getting requests for. So the returns are different. And the risk to reward ratio is much different. So that's the one kind of investor that we often come across, which is unrealistic expectations.
Jim, the second kind of investor I see that's been hiding in the investment bunker for a long time is someone who is really starting to feel the pain of being in cash. As you mentioned, they've watched their purchasing power decrease. They've also been noticing more and more the stock market going up while their money is making nearly 0% in CDs or wherever they have it. And so these people feel like, I've missed out on 130% uprun in the stock market. I need to make up for all that return I let go by being in cash. So I'm going to go out there and pick the highest risk investment I can to try to get the highest return I can to make up for what I lost by being in cash for all this time. And that's another unhealthy perspective because, again, we're just in a completely different market than we used to be. And I'm not sure that we can offer an investment, or anyone can, that can make up for 130% loss of potential return by being in cash for the last 5 years.
No. And the way you see this is they'll chase the highest dividend yield out there. And usually, if you're only going after the highest dividend yield, you better know what you're looking at. You better know the business plan, the business cycle, how this company performs in the business cycle. Why is that dividend yield high? Is that dividend in jeopardy? Are they paying out more in dividends than they're earning in terms of earnings, and also, even more importantly, than what they're taking in cash flow? And so you're right. It's the guy that says, gosh, I've been zero. Now I'm going to go for broke. I want to find the next Apple. I want to find the next super stock where I can double and triple, and I'm going to put all my chips on one color on the roulette wheel. And that's equally as dangerous, because now they're getting more desperate. And what they're going to do is they're taking on an inordinate amount of risk and they don't realize it.
And then, Jim, it is kind of nice when I get a call from someone who is approaching this movement out of where they've been in cash and gold with a more rational approach. Someone who says to me, okay, I know I've been heavily invested in precious metals and in cash for a long time, and it hasn't been working for me, so I'm willing to take on a more rational, realistic portfolio that's a little bit more diversified. There are people who are willing to consider going back in the stock market again with a portion of their portfolio, you know, between 50 and 60, maybe 70% of their portfolio, and have some exposure to bonds as well, maybe 20 to 30%, and then have an exposure to metal because we still think metal is a good inflation hedge, a good dollar hedge, and have a little bit in cash to buy when there's a dip in the market. So we do get some people, Jim, who are approaching this from a very rational standpoint and saying, okay, I've been wrong for 5 years, so I'm willing to try something a little bit different now.
You know what amazes me about this is, Kathleen, you're going through the CFP course. Anybody that has taken an investment course in college or is going for a certification in the investment field, and I don't care if you're a CFA, a CFP, one of the first things that they're going to tell you about is the importance of diversification. And there's a reason for that. I mean, we interview on this program some very smart people, and people that are very diverse in terms of their opinions, in terms of what they think. We're in a bear market, or we're in a bubble, the stock market's going higher. Even technicians that we have in the program, which goes to show you, you know, here you have people that have been trained in technical analysis, and they can look at a chart And you can have two technicians look at that chart and walk away with two different conclusions. You'll have one that'll say, I think the stock market is going higher based on what I see. And then you have another one that'll say, no, I think we're at a top and we're going lower. So the important point is nobody is smart enough to predict where this market's going to be 1 year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. And this is something that I highlighted on the program last week. I'm reading Ben Graham's 1940 edition of Security Analysis. And this was his second edition. And this was 7 years after you wrote the first edition, which was in 1932, which was the bottom of the stock market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 90%. And what Graham was saying, looking at the stock market and trying to become a good investor 7 years later, he was seeing increased government regulation that came in with the New Deal. He was seeing artificially suppressed interest rates with the Federal Reserve. He was seeing government intervention in the economy at all levels, whether it was through monetary policy, fiscal policy, or regulations. He was seeing the advent of inflation. And furthermore, at the time he wrote the 1940 edition, war had broken out in Europe. So what Graham was basically saying is, look, I can't predict if I'm looking at a company and I study their earnings. I can't say, well, they're going to make a buck a share this year in earnings. 5 years from now, I'm predicting those earnings are going to grow at 10% a year. And therefore, it's going to be $1.50 5 years from now. What I can do is diversify. What I can do is buy a dollar's worth of assets for 50 cents. That gives me my margin of safety. And later on, this is one of Warren Buffett's favorite books, was The Intelligent Investor. So here Graham, writing in The Intelligent Investor several decades later, after he has had a lot more experience, 50 years experience in the market, he talks about having cash, diversification, as a better way to protect oneself against uncertainty, which is unpredictable.
So, Jim, given what Benjamin Graham was talking about in terms of the unpredictability of certain parts of the stock market, buying with a margin of safety, and the Buffett's approach to being invested in the stock market and quality companies, if I'm someone who's been in this crash-proof portfolio for a while, I've had my dollar assets there to prevent against a market crash. I've had my gold assets there to protect against a dollar crash. If I'm close to retirement or in retirement, what should I do to change my portfolio to make it be a little bit more balanced and be a little bit more productive for me as I move into my retirement years?
You know, if I was putting together a portfolio from scratch today, given those parameters, somebody that's, I don't know, 5-10 years away from retirement or in retirement itself, Kathleen, I'd probably have 10% in gold because I do think currencies are being debased around the globe. Central banks are printing money. I would have 10% in cash. I would probably have 40% in a laddered bond portfolio with inflation index bonds, meaning that if interest rates rise or inflation, they would participate, and hybrid bonds, the same thing. And then I would have about 40% of my portfolio in dividend paying blue chip stocks. So that way, I've got a diversified portfolio. If we're in deflation, inflation, I have enough diversity between asset classes that if one area is not doing well, for example, the gold market right now or cash, that's not where I have all my money.
Part of this allocation you just outlined is a 10% allocation to cash. Now, we just got done talking about the risks to cash and how cash is a bad place to be during certain points in the market. Why would you be keeping 10% in cash right now?
Well, the one thing that we have seen, Kathleen, since 2009, we have climbed the proverbial wall of worry. We've had one crisis after another. 2010, it was a double dip recession. 2011, it was the debt ceiling debate. It was Europe. It was Greece, Fukushima. 2012, it was the fiscal cliff, the sequester this year. So we've had corrections. And one of the things that you always want to do is if the stock market corrects, you want to have some cash to take advantage of those things that you would like to buy at a lower price. You don't want to say, hey, I'm 100% fully invested. The market just corrected 10% and a stock I really want to own just got down to a level I think is an incredible buy. So you have that cash for that flexibility, for emergencies or for opportunities. So you still want to keep cash. And Graham talked about that in a portfolio.
The other thing I want to talk to you about is bonds. You mentioned an allocation to bonds as being part of this portfolio. Can you explain a little bit more about that? Because we also mentioned that bonds are particularly vulnerable to currency issues as well. So why would you suggest being in bonds? And could you also address bond funds versus individual bonds as well?
Well, let's talk about having bonds, and we'll go back to a period of severe market duress, which was 2008 following the Lehman crisis. Kathleen, had you had this portfolio, and we've gone back and back-tested, if you were in gold at the end of 2008, gold held up its value. It dipped short-term, but by the end of the year, it held its value. The 10% in cash obviously would have not been disturbed. Now, the 40% you had, if let's say it was a laddered bond, as interest rates came down and the risk-off trade dominated the financial markets as people looked for safety, your bond portfolio would have been up. On the other hand, your 40% in blue chip dividend paying stocks, that would have been down anywhere from 20 to 30% versus, let's say, the stock market that was down over 40%. So the idea is you don't know what the outcome is going to be 3 years or 5 years from now. Look at 2011, where we had a severe stock market correction between August and September as we were treated to nightly headlines that the U.S. could possibly default on its debt. It was a period that bonds did very well. It was also a period that the European crisis blew up with concerns about Greece exiting the euro. So money flowed into the dollar and flowed into bonds as it is doing right now with the crisis in Cyprus and also Japan's currency losing 18% since November. So you want to have some money in bonds, and we would do individual bonds because I have a definite maturity date. I can be more flexible in terms of my risk. I don't have dilution of income. And I also have an inflation protection. For example, if I have an inflation index bond, if interest rates go up or inflation goes up, then my rate of return is going to go up. So I'm protected.
So it sounds like, Jim, what you're suggesting is that let's just say I'm someone who has 50% in cash to hedge against market risk, 50% in gold to hedge against currency risk. You're suggesting, okay, take your gold position down to 10% and replace the other 40% of gold with 40% in high quality equities. That's going to be your currency crash, if that's how you're thinking. That's your currency crash hedge. And then with the other half of the portfolio, you're going to be invested instead of 50% in cash, take that down to 10% and put the other 40% into bonds. And that's your market crash protection. So you're still covering your currency crash and your market crash. You're just being a little bit more diversified and a little bit more rational with how you're approaching it, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Once again, nobody that I've had on this program or anybody I will have on this program in the future is smart enough to say, you know what, Jim, in the year 2015, this is where the stock market's going to be. This is where interest rates are going to be. This is where the dollar's going to be. This is where gold's going to be. Nobody is that smart. And this goes back to Ben Graham's philosophy. Now, those percentages I gave you, Kathleen, 10% gold, 10% cash, 40 bonds, 40% blue chip dividend paying stocks. I mean, you can play with those figures, you know, depending on a person's personality. They might want more than 10% gold. They might want to go maybe 15 or 20. But even people that I've had on this program that are, you know, in favor of gold and gold proponents like Dr. Mark Faber said he would have no more than 20% in gold. And yet we see people that have 60 and 70% in gold. Or they might want to have more than 10% in cash because they have future expenses. Maybe they want 20%. But I would say as a general framework, that's sort of like an ideal allocation, and you would probably have to modify that depending on what a person's income needs are, based on what a person's risk tolerance is. But I would say overall, that would be a general allocation framework to work with.
So sort of a rule of thumb starting point to develop your own particular portfolio, that some version of that, give or take a few percentage points here or there.
Exactly.
We started this program talking about many of our listeners out there that we have contact with who have what we've been jokingly calling a doomsday portfolio or an end of the financial market portfolio, mostly cash, mostly gold. We've talked about some of the downsides of having a portfolio allocated that way. And we've suggested that if you're looking for a portfolio that will still have the ability to stand up to a dollar crash and or a market crash, you can actually move out of those two very narrow areas of cash and gold to a laddered bond portfolio and some exposure to dividend-paying stocks, and you'll have a portfolio that still performs well under those two circumstances, but has a lot more flexibility to take into account other circumstances that come to the market. Next, we're often surprised at how many people don't take advantage of employer-sponsored retirement programs. Employer contributions to retirement accounts are essentially what I like to call bonus money. So listen again to Brainless is Painless, Efficient Retirement Investing from our February 25th program. This week, we're going to talk a little bit more on the savings that you do to prepare for retirement. We're going to be talking a little bit later in the program with Joel Mee. He's actually representative of The Standard, which is a group that specializes in customized pension and retirement plans for different types of employers. So, Jim, I'm assuming today we'll be talking about different types of retirement plans at some level and the tax benefits of how those might help out your tax situation, and then also about how to invest those retirement plans so that they work the strongest and the hardest for you.
Yeah, because when we talk about, Kathleen, planning for retirement, which is what we do here in Lifetime Income, the most important thing that you have to take into consideration, how can you do that most efficiently? And it involves two things. One has a tax component to it, and then there's an investment component. And probably the most efficient way to save for retirement is using some kind of form of pension plan, because the government allows numerous options, defined benefit, 401ks, which is what we're going to be talking about with our guest today. But what this allows, there's three reasons that you want to do this. Number one is you're going to get a tax deduction. So let's just simplify this as an illustration, and let's assume you make $10,000 a year. Most people make more than that, but just bear with me in terms of illustration. If you make $10,000 a year and you put $1,000 of your $10,000 in earnings into a 401k plan, a pension plan, profit sharing, SEP IRA, whatever the pension plan is, number one, that $1,000 is subtracted from your income on the front page of your tax return. So automatically, you're getting a tax deduction because the government is not going to tax you on that. So that's the first benefit that you get. The second benefit that you're going to get is that oftentimes in many retirement plans at companies, especially with 401k plans, your employer may match your contribution. So, Kathleen, imagine you put in $1,000 and your employer matches your $1,000 with either $1,000, $500. Automatically, you've got a 100% return on your money, or 50% return, depending on how high or how much your employer matches. So that's a second benefit. And then the third benefit is while you're making investments inside the retirement plan, any dividends, any interest you earn, any capital gains that you take, they are tax deferred and do not enter your tax picture. So obviously, if I can make income, dividends, and rates of return and not have to pay taxes on it, I'm obviously going to accumulate a lot more money than if I had to pay 25, 28, 30 plus state taxes, or 40 or 50% to the government on my investment income.
You know, Jim, I'm really glad you're talking about this, the three benefits of investing in an employer-sponsored retirement plan. You know, you and I were talking last week about research that shows that nearly half of people over 55 have saved less than $50,000 for retirement, and almost half of all Americans are not participating in their employer 401k plans. And I'm quite surprised, Jim, because I frequently get the question from existing and potential clients, should I invest in my 401k? And I'm really surprised by this because, as you pointed out, there is a great tax benefit on the upfront side to your income level. And there's tax-deferred growth, which is another thing that's of benefit. And I always remind people, if your employer's going to match, that's essentially free return. That's like guaranteed return on your money by putting it into an employer-sponsored retirement plan. So for me, I think it's a great way to go ahead and save for retirement. And I think those of you out there that do have employer-sponsored retirement plans and can afford to defer the income, it's a great way to reduce your tax load and have your investments grow for the long haul.
Oh, I agree with you. But one of the reasons we don't see people do that, I think, you know, is probably, Kathleen, immediate gratification versus delayed gratification. It's something I'm going to bring up when I interview our guest today, Joel Mee. You know, you take a look at somebody that's just out of college. Okay, you worked hard, you got your college degree, you get your first job, you're on your own, you're earning this money, and you're thinking, oh, this is great. I want to buy a new car. I want to get my own apartment. Or you're married, and maybe you're starting out your family and you're thinking, boy, the first thing for us is to buy a house. You're thinking that's immediate. That's something tangible. That's something that I can see right now. Versus, you know, if you're in your 20s or even your 30s, you're thinking, gosh, retirement, gosh, when I'm 65, that's 40 years from now. That's 30 years from now. And so there's this kind of, I think of the analogy, the devil on the one side of the shoulder and the angel on the other side. Well, substitute immediate gratification for delayed gratification. And oftentimes, in fact, in so many cases, immediate gratification often wins out because you can say, well, if I don't put that money in the 401k plan or a pension plan, SEP IRA, whatever it is, I can spend it now. I can go out and have a good time. I can buy a nicer car. Versus if I take that money aside and I put it away out of sight, out of mind, I've now established something. So I think the real key to making this work is becoming disciplined and saying, okay, I'm going to come up with a budget. I'm going to put X amount of dollars into a retirement plan so that I never see it. And then I'll learn to live on what I have in the balance.
Jim, I'm really glad you mentioned that last point. I have this little phrase I tell people about saving for retirement or saving in general. Brainless is painless. So if you have automatic deductions taken out of your paycheck and pushed directly to your 401k, or you have your employer put part of your money into it directly into a savings account so it never hits your checking account, you never know it's gone. You never miss it. So if you're able to make automated contributions you don't have to think about, you just don't feel it the same way. I was also thinking, Jim, I think a lot of people don't realize exactly how much money they can put away in their 401k. If you're under certain ages, 55, you can contribute $17,500, and there's a catch-up contribution of $5,500. That's $23,000 a year you could be putting away for retirement and deducting from your taxes. If you're a high-income earner, that's not a small deduction.
No, and it gets even better than that when you think of a lot of 401k plans. You'll have employers that will match you 100% up to a certain limit or 50%. And you think about that, Kathleen. How many people would like to make an investment today in the first year, earn 50% or 100%, whatever the matching contribution is? So it's not only that you're putting money aside for yourself, but also your employer is contributing to it. But once again, we get into this argument, delayed gratification versus immediate gratification. And there's been studies, and I would invite our listeners to go online and take a look at these calculations. Look up a retirement savings where you could say, okay, I'm 25. What happens if I want to have $1 million when I retire? Because I hate to tell you, folks, you're going to need $1 million if you're going to retire in the future, given the low interest rates and the cost of living. But it'll tell you, if I put X amount of dollars, if I want to have $1 million, you put in your age, and let's say you're 25, 35, whatever it is, how much would I have to put aside today at age 25 or 35 versus 10 years later or 20 years later? I think you're going to be absolutely shocked when you hear the difference between those two costs, because, you know, it's the magic. It's one of the seventh wonders of the world, compound interest. That's how you build great wealth. But the important thing is developing the discipline to do it now when it's out of sight and out of mind.
Jim, I just want to make one last point about 401k contributions that are employer matched at some level. If your employer came to you and said, you know what, let's just say you came to me and said, Kathleen, I'm going to give you a $6,000 bonus this year. And do you think I'm going to say, Jim, I'm going to turn that down? Absolutely give me a $6,000 bonus. If you're not contributing to your 401k and your employer's offering a match, you're essentially turning down what amounts to a tax-deferred bonus. So don't turn your employer's free bonus money down. Take it and run. Jim, let's actually switch topics a little bit and talk about, okay, so now I have this money in my retirement account, IRA, 401k, whatever it is. What should I do with that money? How should I be investing it so it's the most efficient and effective for me inside that tax-deferred structure?
You know, a lot of it, Kathleen, once again, depends on your risk tolerance, your age, how many years away you are from retirement. But, you know, if you're looking at a longer-term retirement plan, in other words, you've got either a decade or several decades or years before you retire, then, you know, you're going to be better off in something that has more growth potential in equities. And one of the problems that people have, and this was one of the first things I learned when I got in the business, is the advantage of, let's say, dollar cost averaging. And yes, we can all think of the horror stories of the tech crisis and the collapse of the internet bubble going back to the year 2000, 2002, the credit crisis between 2007 and 2009. But bear in mind, most 401k plans, about 60% of the money in 401k plans are invested in mutual funds. The other is in banks, institutions, and insurance companies. And even insurance companies with the use of annuities have mutual funds. So the bulk of the money that goes into these 401k plans or any kind of pension plan is invested in mutual funds. And the thing about it is if you have a long-term time horizon, all that matters when you get to retirement is how many shares that you own in the various assets that are in your portfolio. So if you are having money withheld from your paycheck on a weekly basis, bi-monthly basis, monthly, whatever it is, that money is buying more shares of your stock fund when the market's down than when the market's going up. And all that matters to you 10 years, 20 years, 40 years from now, whenever you retire, is how many shares of that mutual fund or how many shares of that stock do you own? And that's why you've seen study after study. I think of the book that was done. It was a study done by three professors. It was called Triumph of the Optimist. And it was a look at 16 stock markets over the last 100 years. And it was amazing. They talk about the success of long-term investing, long-term compounding, long-term reinvestment of dividends. It's astronomical in terms of the difference. So getting back to your question, Kathleen, a lot of it depends on your age, your risk tolerance. Obviously, somebody that's, let's say, 55 and is maybe 10 years away from retirement should be investing much, much different than somebody that's 25, 35, or 45, or somebody that's 65.
Jim, thinking about this whole idea of dollar cost averaging in, I want to bring up my brainless is painless phrase again. Most retirement plans are set up where you can actually just set up automatically so that every time you have a contribution into your 401k, it's divided among two or three or four different mutual funds. Now, I'm not saying this is one of those things where you just keep the contribution going behind the scenes without you really worrying about it. You still need to check in on your investment from time to time. But if you're able to just have automatic contributions to various different types of mutual funds, again, it's painless. You don't feel it. You don't have to worry about it or stress about it. It just happens in the background.
Yeah, and it's not just that you don't have to worry about it, but remember, once again, you're looking at a long-term time horizon. And I think so many times, in addition to the conflicts that we have to deal with immediate gratification versus delayed gratification, Kathleen, we're often dealing with the fears of the market. I mean, you just take a look at the crises that we've gone through in the last decade, the collapse of the tech bubble, 9/11, the Gulf War, Katrina and Rita, the credit crisis, the euro crisis, the debt ceiling crisis. I mean, we deal with crises, and the media tends to overdramatize these crises. And so investors operate from fear and looking at the short-term perspective versus a longer-term perspective. You wouldn't think about if you bought a house, you're living in your home, and all of a sudden your neighbor got into financial trouble and they had to sell their house at a discount, would you say to yourself, oh my goodness, housing prices went down in our neighborhood, I better dump my house now. You know, people really ought to take a longer-term view, and they ought to invest appropriately for their age and understand what it is that they're investing. And I think if you add all of that and take a more disciplined, a more reasoned approach, and you have a plan, you know, the chances are you're going to be much more successful, number one, and especially the earlier that you start. And number two, if you have a plan, that you stick to that plan, maybe modify it as your needs change or as you get older or your financial circumstances change, you're more likely to be successful rather than find yourself reacting to a crisis or even worse. As the years go by, all of a sudden you wake up one day and you say, oh my, the kids are out of college. They've moved out of the house. We're empty nesters. I'm only 10 years away from retirement and I don't have much money. So I think having a plan is also important.
Jim, when people call me and talk to me about their 401k plans or their other retirement plans, one of their comments is, I have five mutual funds I can invest in or 10 mutual funds, and I have no idea what to invest in. And I think part of the problem here is just not knowing where to go to find more information about these mutual funds that you're being offered, especially when they have sort of names that don't really mean a whole lot to most people, like value growth or growth, strategic growth, or something like that. That really says nothing to your average investor. Each different mutual fund company typically reports performance on a monthly or quarterly basis, and they typically tend to publish a rough breakdown of the types of companies they're investing in and usually list their top 10 holdings. So let's say that your plan offers you Vanguard or Fidelity or BlackRock mutual funds. Go to the Fidelity's website or Vanguard's website or BlackRock's website and type in the symbol or the name of the fund you're looking for that's offered by your plan, and you should see a whole lot of information pop up about performance and holdings and all those sorts of things. So don't feel like you're blind investing in things that are offered by your retirement plan. Do a little digging, do a little research, and make the internet work for you by finding this information online.
You know, another point I'd bring up here too, Kathleen, is don't go chasing performance. A lot of times, and especially depending on what phase we are in the business cycle, we see a lot of rotation out of one sector where you'll have a 20-week period where, let's say, utility stocks are the hot things because we're in the risk-off trade. So utilities are producing high rates of return. Or you'll find a year where, I don't know, technology stocks are doing well, energy stocks are doing well, gold stocks, whatever the sector is. And what'll happen is investors, when they're looking for their rates of return, oh, that's the number one performing fund. That's the number one performing sector. Not understanding where we are in the business cycle. And what often happens is they'll chase investment performance. And Kathleen, you're on the receiving end of this because you know what the phone calls are like, especially when we've had a big surge in the price of gold or gold stocks are surging. You'll get a flood of calls. Oh, I want to get in the gold market because, you know, gold stocks are up 30 and 40%. And what they end up doing is chasing performance rather than taking a balanced approach, taking a look at risk and saying, this is who I am as an investor in terms of my risk tolerance. These are my goals. This is the kind of risk I can withstand and understand what that risk is. I wonder if you might address that because you often get these questions in the phone calls.
I really do, Jim, and I can see the temptation in that. I really can. If I'm an investor and I maybe don't know a lot about the market and I'm looking and I'm comparing, you know, 10 different mutual funds, I'm starting to get cross-eyed trying to figure out what to do. Looking at performance, especially recent performance, seems like a really easy way to pick a good investment. And this is why I think it's really good for the investor to just dig a little deeper in that information and look at the underlying holdings. What types of companies is this particular mutual fund investing in? Do those companies make sense to me? Does the allocation of the mutual fund make sense to me? Because I think that you're right, Jim. I think a lot of people have that temptation to say, I'm going to pick the fund that was up 30% last year rather than the fund that was up 10% because I know the 30% one's going to do better without bothering to take a look at, like you said, the economic cycle, etc. So again, just really want to encourage people to take a look at the underlying investments and really see if they make sense to you before you start dropping your money down in it.
Well, Kathleen and I are looking forward to covering new topics related to personal finance and retirement in the upcoming weeks. So tune in next week for more of Lifetime Income. And if there's any kind of special topic that you would like to see us cover here, send us an email at the program. We just recently covered a special needs trust with an attorney here. And a lot of that had to do with you, our listeners. So if there's a topic, estate planning, investments, insurance, give us a jingle and we'll cover it on the program. So on behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Hope you enjoyed the program. We'll be back again next week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.